Talking with David Frost. A turn of the year conversation from the White House. We begin with the President in the Oval Office.
Mr. President, you haven't declared officially, formally, as a candidate, but you're not going to do a Mario Cuomo on us, are you, and surprise us at the last minute by not running?
No, I don't think so. The thing, what I have said, David, and I still stand by it, said last year, was that only my health would keep me from becoming a candidate, and I have no reason to change that, and the health is just great. So I've been blessed with ups and downs in that department, minor downs, but strong finish in the year, feeling just terrific. So I see no contingency that would keep me from becoming a candidate.
Yes. But you always do say, you said a year ago when we were together, only my health. You still say only my health. People worry that you've got something in the back of your mind that they don't know about.
Well, if I said that last year, then I could look back on earlier last year and we'd see that I did have a little flare-up with the thyroid, but I have been given a clean bill of health. And in this job, you have every single inquiring doctor from around the country poring over medical records. So no, there's no hidden agenda, and I have never felt any better. So I'm blessed in that regard.
So when will you formally declare? I mean, do you
probably
want to do it
soon,
now? Just
probably
to get it
fairly
over?
Soon. But we got some timing, and it relates to the primaries. But I would say to you, fairly soon.
Fairly soon.
Fairly soon.
When we talked a year ago, it was a time when you first used the R word, the recession word. That word has hung around much longer than you or the Fed really would have predicted or anticipated, hasn't it?
Or 49 of the 50 blue-chip economists would have predicted, or the rest of the country would have predicted. And the OECD would have predicted. What happened was there was a kind of a recovery moving. I say kind of a recovery because it wasn't as vigorous as coming out of other recessions. But in the third quarter, there was some economic growth, and people started planning optimistically. And then it just turned sluggish and flat again. So there's been a lot of people that have failed to predict the turnaround, and I've been one of them.
So
you pay the price.
That's right. At the same time, does the 1% cut by the Fed mean that your growth package, does it take the pressure off you? Do you have to do less because of that?
Well, I think it was a very important step. It was dramatic. It was big. It was very well received. You see confidence in home owners that already own mortgages coming back a little bit, even at the end of the year. And so it was a very big and important step. But I don't think it means that we don't need to have some kind of a growth package to stimulate jobs and stimulate investment. And so that, I think it was a very helpful step. It will have a very beneficial effect on the economy in a few months. It was good for confidence, but it alone is not all that needs to be done.
And when you look at the growth package, what have you got to add to that? I mean, the jobs thing is a real worry for people because it does seem as though a lot of these jobs that have been going have been abolished permanently almost, by trimmed forever by GM and other people, 74,000 jobs. That makes it more serious, doesn't it?
Well, it does. Fortunately, on a national basis, the unemployment remains significantly less than in the recession of 1981-82. Unemployment got nationally up over 10.5%, and it's been hovering around 6.8, 6.9, around 7% in the United States. So there's a blessing in all of that. But what's happening is, with this lack of confidence and sluggishness in certain industries, some of them are restructuring and trying to get leaner and tougher and more competitive. And so there will be a reorientation of jobs. That means the need for job retraining, and that means a different problem that we face in the employment market. Fortunately, the totals remain not satisfactory, but less bad than in some previous recessions.
Alan Greenspan said that people are more anxious, although the recession in a way is less steep, people are more anxious than they've ever been before that somehow future standards of living here in America are not going to be as high as in the recent past. There's more anxiety. It may be less debt, but there's more anxiety you've got to deal with.
No question. So while some statistics can be encouraging, there is a lack of confidence that probably is worse than in the last recession. And that we've got to try to turn around. I don't think the federal government can turn it around unilaterally. But that's why I will be pressing hard to have a growth package that actually does something, not just a political package, but something that really will stimulate investment and thus stimulate jobs.
Do you think in order to do what's necessary, you may have to breach or renegotiate the budget deal of 1990?
Well, I think one bad signal to send to the markets would be that we are going to eliminate the caps, the controls on controllable federal spending. I think that would, there was one proposal, David, up at the end of the year that was just going to cut a great big tax cut for everybody that would bust the budget agreement. And the day that happened, that afternoon, long-term interest rates shot up. And of course, I don't think that the price should be increasing people's interest rates and stimulating inflation and all of that. So I want to see us live within these spending caps. Now, there may be room to for some maneuvering there, but I do not want to see the federal spending go out of control again.
So in that sense, the budget deal of 1990 is sacred.
Well, it is a very important discipline. Now, there are ways within the budget caps to reorient things, but we are not, I am not suggesting that that's what I want to do at this juncture. There are ways to live within the caps and then juggle around inside, but that would take new legislation.
But would you be prepared to bridge the boundaries between the different sections of the budget?
Well, we have already reduced defense spending, and it is possible that there will be more reductions in defense spending.
And you might spend that in the domestic. You might spend that in the domestic section.
Could be, or might do something radical like reduce the deficit, which seems to be some people have a great interest in, including me.
Yeah. Talking of defense, when Dick Cheney's original plan came out, that was at a time before the latest changes in the Soviet Union and so on, or whatever we now call it and so on. And you were saying there, we might better find, the Pentagon seemed to think, we might better find another $50 billion in defense saving?
Well, we had some year-end discussions with the defense secretary on that. They are being extraordinarily cooperative in trying to come to the president with recommendations in that very area. So I'm going to stop short of saying giving you numbers, but with our enormous successes around the world, I think there are ways that we can save more in defense. And I think the secretary feels that way. But I don't want to do it in a way that does not have us ready to respond if we have to emergencies anywhere around the world. It's only the United States now that, with the demise of the Soviet Union, that has this disproportionate responsibility, it seems to me.
But you're highly hopeful there can be further defense savings.
Oh, I think so, yeah.
Do you think at this moment, redrafting the old President Reagan slogan, do you think if you ask people at the moment, this is not November now, this is the beginning of the year, but if you ask them now, are you economically better off than you were 3 years ago? Do you think many people would say yes?
Today, no. If you said economically, because I think there is a lack of confidence out there across this country. And I think that'll turn around, incidentally. But if I had to answer that question now economically, I don't think so, although I saw some very interesting polling figures at the end of the year that showed, well, I'm about the same as I was, and some better, and some say worse. It's not quite as dramatic as some of the political opponents would have you believe, but that really isn't the point. The point is, we've got to get this economy moving, we've got to get more jobs, we've got to pass programs to the degree stimulative programs will do it, that will help people.
When do you think, gazing into the future, when will the budget deficit be zero?
Well, it's hard to say, but it won't be for the next 4 or 5 years unless Well, it won't be, because
it wouldn't be before your third term, for instance.
No, there could. You might make a case that if we do what I feel needs to be done in the way I feel it needs to be done, that it'll be in pretty good shape towards that end before the end of this, before the end of the 90s. But given what's happened on the SNLs and the banks and the excesses of the lending fraternity, why, it's going to take a lot longer than originally predicated.
A lot longer, yes. But the growth rate, when do you see the word recession disappearing and real recovery happening, real jobs being found? Sometime this year?
Yes, no question about it.
When this year, do you think?
Well, again, you can only go by the macroeconomists and their predictions, and most of them are saying end of the second quarter and clearly doing that in the third quarter. Having said that, why, they haven't been too accurate, but that, I mean, if you're going to put your trust in people that watch the economy, that is what they are saying. 49 out of 50 of them now are roughly in that position. But not predicting the enormously vibrant growth that I would like to see for the country.
How much effect, Mr. President, do you think the economy this year is going to have on your re-election? Do you think you could be re-elected without a recovery?
I think I'm going to be re-elected.
With or without a recovery?
Sure. But it makes it very difficult, I mean, because... and, you know, it depends who the opponent is and what the opponent claims, that what magic wand he would wave in order to solve these inexorable problems.
The first problem you
but
have...
But I think I will be reelected. I predicate that, of course, that I think the economy is going to be doing much better. I think confidence will be coming back. I think people now know that we are trying hard. I don't think they did at first. And I think also you got a whole wealth of other performance out there that American people are grateful for. But I'm certainly going into this as a dog-eat-dog fight, and I will do what I have to do to be reelected.
The first dogs that have to be eaten, or whatever it is, of course, you've got to deal with your own party first. I mean, what would you regard as victory? What do you regard as your target against Pat Buchanan in New Hampshire?
We don't have a target. I regard victory when people say, hey, this person won, the other man lost. And that's the way you got to approach a fight like this. But we'll go on to all these states, and I think I'll do pretty well. But
you mean you'd be satisfied with 51% in New Hampshire?
I'm not saying I'd be satisfied, but that's victory. That's victory.
And do you share the feelings that, for instance, William Buckley expressed at great length in his essay? Do you share the feelings that Pat Buchanan has been guilty of anti-Semitic remarks?
I'd let others make that determination. I honestly haven't spent the time researching his remarks or his record, and I would leave that for others, because what I want to try to do is help restore confidence, get more jobs for the American people, go on about being president of the United States, and let others worry about that.
He wouldn't be your selected candidate for 1992, but do you think he has presidential timber, that he could be a serious candidate in 1996?
Nice try, David. I'm going to let the American people sort that out in the campaign. He's not very well known. He'll have an opportunity to say what he's for. He'll have an opportunity to respond to these questions you're most appropriately asking, but let others do that, not me.
There's no doubt about your other opponent. You do believe that David Duke is a racist.
Well, I definitely believe that, and a bigot to boot, and I've made that very clear earlier on. It's an ugliness there that I have to speak out against as President of the United States.
Do you think if he... you defeated him for the nomination, etc., obviously. But do you think if he stood as an independent in the election, he could have an effect?
No. No, I don't.
You don't think he'd get many votes?
No. I think fair play in this country is such that he would be overwhelmingly rejected. And I just think that that he won't have much following.
Less than 10%?
Well, I couldn't even put a percentage, but that would surprise me if it was anything like 10%. We've got to come together when one comes out of this recent white sheet past and whose rhetoric is still laced with subtle bigotry. I mean, I've turned my back on that and will continue to, and we'll speak out against it wherever it is, whether it's in the political arena or someplace else.
William Safire the other day described you as a moderate. Do you like that description?
No, it depends what it relates to. I'm basically conservative, and I've always been that way, but everybody's got a different description of these words. I didn't see his column, so I don't know
he was trying to be helpful, of course, as all journalists naturally are. And first of all,
you don't want to debate on that, do you?
Maybe we haven't got time.
Yeah, okay.
But one of the most hugest controversies this year, controversies, depending on where you're pronouncing the word, obviously was the Clarence Thomas nomination.
Yes.
When you used your famous words, would you rewrite those words at all now, picking the best man for the job on the merits?
I think he proved to come out of that with enough support around this country that others agree with me. But I think it was a very good choice. I think he'll make a superb justice, and he went through hell to get there.
When you said merits, though, one of the merits you were looking for was presumably that he was black.
Well, presumably
there was a black representative on the Supreme Court.
I think that's very useful. That's very useful. But I didn't start out saying I'm going to have a black to replace him. But it worked out very well. And he went through a tough time, but I don't know what his position is going to be on any issue. But I like the background, the grassroots feel of his character, and I like what I was told was his record on the bench.
Do you actually know where he stands on abortion?
No.
Even you don't know that?
I don't know, and it was never discussed. And some cynics find that hard to believe, but that's the truth.
And after everything that happened and he got that narrow vote in his favor, some senators who voted for him have suggested that Professor Anita Hill should be tried for perjury. Do you agree with that?
I think the matter's best left sitting where it is. The legal process is moving forward in the Senate. They're trying to determine whether their rules were broken in leaking material out of FBI files, and so let them continue that. But I don't know that this whole matter needs to be reopened. I had some real differences with the way it was conducted, the hearings were conducted, feeling that the American people didn't have to have all that explicit sex brought into the living room of every 12-year-old kid in this country. They can do those things behind closed doors. We elect people to do, represent their people. And so we were offended, I was offended from a family standpoint by some of this, and so were a lot of other people. So we made some suggestions on that, but I think it's better to, let her go out and do her thing, give her speeches, and let Clarence get on with being a good justice.
But did you form an opinion on whether she lied or whether she was honestly mistaken?
I just think it ought to be, I don't think it does any good if I want this matter to lay to rest, to go back and reopen my own personal feelings on it. I tried to avoid that at the time, so I think I'm disinclined at this point to editorialize further on it. But I must say, I think the Senate reached the proper conclusion.
Why
so
was it?
You
talked about filth.
Therefore, I come down on his side quite clearly.
You talked about the airwaves being contaminated by some of this explicit sex and so on. In addition to that, why was it such a wrenching experience, for the American people? Was it
because it brought up
the war between men and women and harassment and all of that, or what?
Well, that was a kind of a sidebar, but I think it was the thing that captivated the nation. and did result, in my view, in the excess, was just the drama of this thing. Last-minute accusation with these specific allegations brought up after the Senate had moved moved his nomination forward. And the timing had people wondering what's going on here, and so it had a kind of a dramatic effect to it. But one of the unfortunate byproducts was this indulgence in such specificity to turn people off.
Well, those restrictions would apply equally strongly to the blanket coverage of the William Kennedy Smith trial,
exactly.
Too, which did the same thing, didn't it?
Exactly. Why, when you get into this kind of vivid and gory detail of a person's physical sexual prowess or lack thereof, why does that have to be brought into everybody's living room? Why not do that to spare families that might be offended? That's not censorship. Let them have their trial. But does it have to be televised with that much graphic sex into every living room? I don't think it does. I think we've gone too far in that kind of thing. And I'm troubled by it. I worry, the longer I'm in this job, about what we call family values. And I just think that explicit coverage in the long run tends to undermine the values of society.
Leading on from what we were talking about, there was the Civil Rights Bill this year and so on. As you look at, Mr. President, at the nation at the moment, would you say that we've reached a stage yet where blacks and whites have an equal playing field, a level playing field in this country, or not?
I think the two pieces of civil rights legislation that I was for, the ADA, which was the Americans for Disabilities Act, which was very forward-leaning for minorities, and but particularly for disadvantaged, but it's big, bold civil rights legislation. And then the legislation I signed last year that is not quota legislation, but is good civil rights legislation, I think that helps. But is there more to be done? Yeah. And a lot of it isn't legislative. What needs to be done is just plain goodwill between people. And unfortunately, we see too much evidence that we've got a ways to go there.
But the playing field is not level yet.
Level in what sense? Legally?
Legally, and it's, in terms of rights, and in terms of entitlements, and in terms of living standards.
I think legally and rights it probably is certainly much more level than it's ever been. But what we're talking about here, I think, is there's still some ugly prejudice in this country. And it's not near as bad as it used to be. But as long as there are vestiges of bigotry and prejudice, I think it's a responsibility of the president to speak out against it. I'll tell you something that kind of bothered me in the civil rights debate. When I said I was opposed to quota legislation, some on the liberal side of the equation tried to make it that was bad. That was trying to inject something into the debate, and they were just as wrong as they could be.
Well, now that raises a very good point, a vital point, I think, which is where does bad quotas end and good affirmative action begin? What's the difference?
It's not quotas. They're goals and not quotas. That's the way I differentiate between affirmative action that I've always been for and quotas that I will continue to oppose. And it gets into, quotas go into numerical, set numbers for doctors or for, it could go into all kinds of things. And I just don't think our society needs that. And I oppose quotas, and I will continue to oppose quotas.
But how is affirmative action different?
It just sets broad goals without numbers on them and said, look, let's reach out and be sure everybody has a shot here. Do our best to carry the information on job opportunities to minority communities or whatever it is. So it's a very different context. And I'm for the latter, affirmative action, and I'm opposed to these quotas, to setting quotas or passing legislation that would compel employers to enact quotas in order to stay out of some endless series of lawsuits. And we got that in the bill. I started off opposing coming up, had my own bill up there, no quota legislation, and there was endless negotiation, and finally, I think we got legislation that is not quota legislation. Now, the other side would have you believe that we caved in and accepted their quotas, and that is not the case at all. And I'll be taking that case to the American people.
And to put,
but people don't want quotas in this country.
And is that why you stopped the Boyd and Gray directive? Because that would have gone too far.
Well, that had the appearance. It was an internal letter that went out to ask for comments from the various departments, which is all right to do. But it looked like that it was positioning me as opposed to affirmative action. And it wasn't supposed to do that, and so we tried to correct all that.
So that you can, those people who look at the small print of that Civil Rights Act, you can put their minds at rest when some of them say, does the Civil Rights Bill make employment practices that exhibit bias in favor of women and minorities as illegal as practices that discriminate against them? It doesn't.
I'd have to get a lawyer to answer that question. That's too technical for me. It does not, the legislation does not resort in quotas, does not set quotas, nor does it impute quotas. Does it compel people to have certain percentages in order to be compliant with
the law? But it cannot be interpreted as meaning that affirmative action in favor of minorities or women is illegal.
Absolutely not.
No,
I'm sorry, I misunderstood. No, it cannot be interpreted that way, and I think there was some confusion as a result of that memo as to what my position was. What the president's position was, or what the administration's position was. And so I wish that had never kind of gotten circulated, and I think we've moved to correct it. But with some suspicion on the left that this is some secret game plan here, which there's not.
The state of Pennsylvania have asked the Supreme Court to review their abortion law. Would you like the court to take up the case and in the process review Roe versus Wade before the election? Would that be welcome to you?
I have no feeling on timing. I think the court sets its own agenda as to when it should. I'm not familiar with the Pennsylvania case, the details of it. I'm not in favor of Roe versus Wade, and I'm alarmed at the enormous increase in abortions in this country. I just. To use abortion as a family planning device, I mean, my heavens, I find that offensive. So I have differences with people that support Roe Wade on that. And but I haven't really, you know, I'm not trying to indicate as president what the Supreme Court calendar should be. That's something the president ought to stay out of.
Did you approve of Operation Rescue's tactics in terms
no.
of...
Not when you break the law. I don't approve of that. I just think there are kind of orderly ways to protest and do things without breaking the law or disturbing the peace.
Before returning to our conversation with the president, we talked with Mrs. Bush in the Roosevelt Room. How do you feel about progress in the subjects that you care about deeply this year? I was thinking, for instance, of things like AIDS and mm-hmm. the battles against disease.
Well, I get very discouraged about AIDS because I think we're doing well. And just this week, I went to a new, wonderful new center here in Washington and discovered that some of the patients' families don't realize that you can put your arms around them and hug them and they can hold babies, and it's not catching that way. And we've just got a lot of education to do when it comes to AIDS. On how you get AIDS, number one, and number two, on how you treat victims of AIDS. And it's very difficult for them. They can't get housing, they can't get jobs. They really need some special care. But we must educate our children on how you get AIDS. And in many cases, it's a behavioral pattern, and we've got to teach abstinence, and we've got to teach no drugs, and we've really got to work on it. Children, for some reason, think they're immune or immortal. It's not true.
But abstinence may be an ideal, but it's not a necessarily totally realizable one. So we've got to talk about safe sex and all that as well.
There's no such thing as safe sex. I really believe that. I think maybe semi-safe sex, but I don't think you can really say it's safe. I think you have to know, you have to be committed to someone. And I am 66, so you're getting this from an elderly point of view. But I think we've got to be honest with our kids and point out that drugs and promiscuous sex are just an invitation to AIDS.
And you said at South Carolina State College to the young people there, the world will demand much of you.
That's
what,
right.
What did you have in mind when you said that?
Well, because they have such big problems they've got to face. And I must say, they were a great group of kids, and I think they will do more, but I'm encouraging people to keep on keeping on. Don't think because you've got your graduation certificate that you're through. You've got to keep on giving. You've got to keep on learning. Why, the President of the United States has learned the computer this year.
That's very impressive. Mm-hmm. Well, my children, as you know, are 7, 6, and 4. I'm relying on them to teach me in a year.
I think you'd like it, too.
In the family this year, the president used the word clobbered. Kenny Bunkport got clobbered this year, didn't he?
Mm-hmm.
Did you lose many personal things that meant a lot to you?
Do you know, David, I had the most peculiar reaction to all of that. I've had several reactions, I might add. But everything on the ground floor was demolished. I mean, it's the most extraordinary thing you've ever seen. Nothing upstairs. I ended up by thinking we were the luckiest living humans. Nobody was hurt. No things are that important, and maybe we need to be reminded of that every now and then. It's all right.
I was reading the other day, someone was writing that maybe women's liberation has backfired on women, that they've been liberated to work outside the home, but they still have all the responsibilities inside the home. Do you think that's happened a bit?
Yes, I think that has happened a bit. You know, it's very difficult to have a generalization like that because some women work because they have to.
Right.
And some women work because they want to, and some women work because they're expected to. But the women I worry about most are the women who have to. And it's very hard for women who have children to make a go of it. And those are the women I think about a lot.
Tell me, there's an old American tradition that comes to pass this year, once every 4 years.
Leap year? A little leap year for you, David, huh?
Leaping through to the election. I was thinking of campaign year. Are you looking forward to another campaign year?
Well, I thought I wasn't, because I hate to have George abused, but I went up to New Hampshire the other day, and the adrenaline flows, and it's fun to be with people, and people were very kind to me. I suspect it's because I'm white-haired and a little overweight, but anyway, they were darling to me, and I found I loved that. And I adore George Bush. I'd rather talk about George Bush and set the record straight if I can. So I found it was fun. I'm looking forward to it.
Well, I wondered, when you were saying you were in New Hampshire and you spoke out about Congress and so on, I wondered if you were going to be a bit more active this year.
No, I'm just going to, anyone who calls George a liar is not going to have me sitting by twiddling my thumbs. You can count on that.
Yeah.
I mean, I still feel the same way about George Bush. He's an awesome man, and he's the most decent, honest man. So I'm ready to go. They may not let me out of the chute, though, if I don't behave myself.
But you're going to go out there battling for George Bush the man rather than George Bush the president.
George Bush the president. I think he's been superb. So I'm perfectly willing to do both.
And you'd like another 4 years here?
Listen, I told someone the other day, I'd like another 4 years. Period. But I wouldn't mind 4 years at home either, nor would he. In all honesty, we've adored it here. We love the people, and the whole atmosphere at the White House is extraordinary. But the narrative too. And, you know, we still want to fish and garden, and he may want to become a farmer. Who knows, like your friend, or I may want to write novels or something, like my friend I told you about. But either way, I'll be happiest. If I'm with George Bush, I'm happy.
However much you make the White House your own, mm-hmm. you mean it can't mm-hmm. ever be home, really.
Pretty homey, I hate to tell you that. I can see why people hate to leave it. But we've got something to look forward to. We've got these great kids. You know, we barely get to go to our children's homes. George has seen Doro's once, I think, and Marvin's once. Neil's never. I think he's seen George's once. And he's never seen Jebby's house, because we don't feel we can cause that kind of problem for our children. Well, that isn't right. Fortunately, they're good kids and they come home to us.
Yeah, but of course, the Secret Service and everybody around like
well,
that.
Well, we endanger our children. We just don't feel we can do that. I've never been to a grandchild's school play or to an athletic event. I mean, I would go to everyone that I was available for, but I just can't do that.
Everything would get disrupted and so on.
Well, that's right, and it would risk our grandchildren. And I'm just not going to do that. So all I'm saying is there are two sides to this coin. I love my life. I wouldn't change it. But I would still love my life, and I wouldn't change it if we weren't in this job.
After our conversation with Mrs. Bush, back in the Oval Office, we turn to the subject of foreign affairs. Let's move on to the world picture for a moment. More than a moment, indeed, Mr. President. The latest news, do you regret the way that President Gorbachev seems to have been cast aside somewhat summarily?
I think he's handled it very well, but I don't know what he could have done to stand up there and try to say, history, stop in your tracks. And he himself unleashed these passions for freedom. The big thing is Gorbachev will be remembered by history as having accomplished marvelous things. And I have no doubt about that at all.
And do you think this new Commonwealth, it was implied on the Secretary of State's plane home that it might not last. Do you think this new Commonwealth will last?
I think so. I think there'll be some difficult bumps in the road as they go along. But the Alma Ata meetings that they had at year's end were very positive. I think there is a determination to handle the perplexing questions like nuclear weapons and peaceful borders and respect for human rights all in a sound way. There are some big problems out there in terms of economic cooperation and reform, but I think that the people will be supportive of these new republics. I know we will.
We talked earlier on about economic turnarounds in this country. How long will it take for an economic turnaround in what was the Soviet Union?
Long time to get it to realize its full potential. Far longer than it will take in the United States for us to realize our full potential. They've got some tremendous economic problems facing them. But the other side of it is that if they make these proper arrangements for reform packages and make it stick, I think investment will flock over there. I think they're creative people. I know we'll want our private sector will want to do more and more and more and more over there, and you're going to have a whole market that has been, you know, all but closed, or certainly has been handled through managed trade, and has been denied the vitality that'll come from free markets. So it's going to be exciting, but I don't know on timing. I think it'll take a while.
Bob Strauss was saying the other day he'd rather give billions now than risk the danger that happened in Germany and so on with inflation and all that went on there, the danger of fascism. Is there a danger of fascism?
Well, I think that's... I wouldn't say there's a danger of fascism right now. I'm disinclined to think that's going to happen, because I think people, as you see the republics move forward, I think you see the various peoples in the republic saying, look, we're going to be free. We're going to have our own country. We're going to have our own flag. There's something to that. There's something enormously powerful about that.
On the basis of your conversations with him, does Boris Yeltsin really want Russia to join NATO?
I think he does. I think he wants them to join all the Western financial institutions. And I think he is committed to being, you know, having any diminished aspects of a threat, whether it's nuclear or military, to his neighbors. So he said all the right things on that. I think he believes that.
And you don't think that the whole USSR is in serious danger of becoming another Yugoslavia?
No, I don't. I think the representations at Alma Ata, the representations that have gone on here at the end of last year, are important. I think that there's got to be some follow-through there. But I think they are determined to resolve what disputes might exist on borders or taking care of ethnic minorities in one republic or another in a peaceful manner. And that is absolutely essential.
Moving on to the subject of the Gulf and the Middle East, do you think there is any chance, any hope? You've asked, I know, the Pentagon to look at options and so on. Do you think there is any chance, any hope that Saddam Hussein will be overthrown by the end of 1992?
Don't know about the time frame, but he is increasingly isolated. We must make very clear, day in and day out, that his going out of there will result in the Iraqi people having a new chance. Result in the Iraqi people seeing the lifting of the embargoes. Result in the Iraqi people enjoying the much better relations with their own neighbors in the neighborhood and certainly with countries like the United States. And I think there's a real isolation on his part. There's a brutality keeping people from getting food and medicine that they can get under the UN resolutions. And it is my understanding that people are getting more and more discontented with this brutal dictator as each day goes by. But I can't give you a date. But history will show a tyrant of that nature simply cannot last forever by brutalizing his own people.
But we in the West thought, really, didn't we, that humiliating defeat would lead to his overthrow.
And it will.
But it didn't at the time.
Hasn't. But it will.
As you go back and rewrite the past year and so on, when you ended the war, you decided that the slaughter could not go on and that militarily, that it was becoming a slaughter and so on and so forth.
And our objectives were achieved. The United Nations objective, right. The coalition objectives, had been achieved.
But do you sometimes wish that, as a condition of the ceasefire, you would ask for Saddam Hussein to be handed over?
I don't know about handed over, but out of there would have been nice, ex-pluperfect past tense. I mean, sure, but I don't think that means that the coalition failed in some way. The objective was not, under which all these UN resolutions were taken and under which we took military action, was not to get rid of Saddam Hussein, but to see that aggression was punished. And it was, and we should never forget that. But if your question to me is, well, do you wish he'd gone out at the time? Absolutely.
Could we have demanded it, do you think, as a price of a ceasefire?
I don't know. Could have or not.
General Schwarzer.
What was the alternative? I mean, you have to say demanded it or else what? Or else march into the middle of Baghdad? I mean, we have to look at where things were at the time. And would I like to have seen him out? Yeah. Would I like to see him out now? Yes. Would I have liked to have said to the young men and women of our armed forces that did, along with the Brits and the French and the Egyptians and all, okay, now we marched at Baghdad? Wouldn't have worked for a lot of reasons. The coalition would fall apart, and you'd had a very different problems in the neighborhood. By that I mean from his Arab neighbors, and it would not have, I wouldn't have done that, because I don't want to send young men into a war where I can't see that they're going to prevail and prevail rapidly.
Could we, in retrospect, have done any more to help the Kurds or the Shias? Could we have rescinded the agreement about the helicopters, use of helicopters, for instance?
Possibly, but I don't know what dramatic change that would, in terms of history, would have made in terms of getting Saddam out of there. Would it save some lives? Maybe it would have, maybe it wouldn't have.
Do you foresee any circumstances in which there will be further military action against Saddam Hussein?
Well, if I could foresee such circumstances, I probably wouldn't announce it here. But I can see circumstances. Somebody mishandling some UN observers that are there under resolutions by the Security Council, sure. But again, we're keeping our options open. And he is going to comply with these resolutions. And we have some muscle out there, so do some other countries. And hope we don't have to use it. But I've not changed my view on that.
We've kept our options open, too, if Colonel Gaddafi doesn't cooperate over the two alleged conspirators who were responsible for Lockerbie, haven't we? I mean,
well,
I haven't ruled anything in or out there.
These indictments, I'm told, are good indictments. They're sound indictments. The evidence is very, very compelling.
You said Syria had taken a bum rap on this and the Israelis privately sort of disagreed and so on. But as far as you're concerned, the evidence is compelling that the trail leads right to Colonel Gaddafi's door?
Leads right to his door because the people involved in this were allegedly involved in this or intelligence people for the Libyan service. And that's devastating. So he should do this. He should now say, we turn these people over for a fair trial. That's what he ought to do. And we're going down that path. Insist that that be done.
And do you think in the new year now we're going to have to see a situation where you've said that we wouldn't impose a settlement, but that there'll have to be more U.S. mediation to get these Mideast talks moving?
Well, I am first place thrilled that the Middle East talks have taken place. You go back and look at the critics and listen to the political cross currents. Who would have thought that would be possible? But we are not going to dictate a settlement. We are going to be there as catalysts and to encourage the sides to work their problems out one-on-one. And that's a proper role for the United States, and that's where we are. Now, the United States has a certain foreign policy that relates to things like an Arab boycott or to settlements. And I have no problem reiterating American policy, but you're not going to get a settlement by saying, do it just this way. The settlement is going to have to be negotiated between the parties.
The next part of the program is our conversation with the President and Mrs. Bush together in the Roosevelt Room. I was just thinking back to one image that I'll always remember of this year was mothers going off to war. I mean, going off to be part of the military. I mean, and saying goodbye to their children, and it wasn't the husband that was going off to war, it was the mother that was going off to war. I mean, that is such a...
Quite a change.
But of course they wanted to go in many cases. If they tried to, the government tried to say women can't go into action, they fought it.
That's right. There's all, it's a...
The two-way.
Part of the great success was the fact we have an all-volunteer army, and part of the military, and part of the rationale is that people will have more say in what they want to do. So a mother, I want to be a part of this, I can respect that and understand it.
Do you think husbands, potential fathers, should have maternity leave? I mean...
Let her take that one on.
I was just going to think I'll be quiet about that. If that meant the wife went to work, I guess. That seems very funny to me, though. The mother's the one who had the baby and who's tired. But What do you think?
I think
I would have hated to have had you around the house.
Let the company sort it out with their employees. Well, that's the way it is. Certainly don't need the government decreeing
And that's what's really exciting, I think, is what's happening. I believe in 4 or 5 years you're going to find every major company has daycare right on the job, and they'll have better workers, they'll have happier mothers, happier fathers. I think you're going to find that happens. We're seeing it all the time now.
Do you think men and women in America are getting on better or differing more? I mean, we talked about harassment, but I mean, it might be some other issue that's come up. I mean, do you think that, the battle of the sexes is being waged more or less in America at the moment?
I think probably getting along better. I mean, in the sense of not necessarily strengthening a family, but respect for people in the workplace and recognition that women have a right to choose their destiny as much as men do. I mean, I think that's all moved in a more positive direction. But with it comes certain problems. I mean, a child that doesn't have a parent to read to that child, or that doesn't see that when a child is hurting, to have a parent and help out, or isn't neither parent there enough to pick the kid up and dust him off and send him back into the game at school or whatever, that kid has a disadvantage. But in terms of respect, men for women and vice versa, I think that's probably doing much better.
What's been the time of most stress or pressure here at home this year? Was it the war, or was it the Soviet breakup or whatever? When did Lady Eden once said the Suez Canal flowed through her living room at the time of Suez? I mean, when did?
I think when George sent the troops. I think that was the hardest.
It began with that, and it ended with the concern for Americans that are hurting because of this sluggish economy. I mean, when families are having trouble making ends meet, or are thinking, even if they have a job, I might not have one tomorrow. Fear. You worry about that. I worry a lot about it. But I also worried a lot about sending some mother's son into battle. So the year started with the agony of that and ended with the increased feeling on the other point, on the economic point.
As an epilogue to our discussions, we asked the president for his reflections on the global perspective for 1992. Coming to the overall picture of the world at the moment, and your phrase about the new world order and so on, as you look at this confusion of evidence, freedom but chaos in the Soviet Union, total failure to do anything about the painful splitting up of Yugoslavia, Saddam Hussein prevailing, nuclear proliferation a worry, whether it's Algeria or Syria or Iran or whatever, progress and at the same time elements of gloom. Do you see your new world order emerging?
Oh, yeah.
Or do you see it getting cloudier and fuzzier?
I see it's getting clearer and clearer. I see this as a tremendously exciting time. I don't think these kids going to public schools in this country at the grade school level or the high school level or any place have near the fear that a generation precedent had about nuclear holocaust or nuclear weapons or doomsday. They see, and properly so, the emergence of democracies in this hemisphere and in the Republic, the Commonwealth over there. And so I'm inclined to see the glass now half full when the question implies half empty. I'm inclined to see it bountifully full. And I'm inclined to see the U.S. role as absolutely key to the continuation of this move towards democracy around the world.
What is the most important thing in the world to happen in this coming year? I mean, what are the priorities?
I don't think you can set one priority. Just to handle these dramatic changes in the Soviet Union, particularly as it relates to nuclear weapons, with enough leadership and finesse to see that goes well, Obviously, on the trade side, opening up world markets, I look at Japan and think, hey, you've got to do much more there. And I also look at the negotiations for the GATT that we haven't talked about here today, to say we ought to not fall back into trading blocks, but we ought to expand markets by knocking down barriers by successfully concluding the Uruguay round. And I want to do the same thing over here and down to our south and north by getting a North American free trade agreement with Mexico and Canada. That means jobs. Jobs for American workers. And some narrow vision people say, oh, it's going to hurt us with jobs. Well, export jobs. It won't at all. It'll expand markets so we'll have more American jobs. And that one is a key. That one's a key, just as getting more access to the Japanese market's a key, just as getting a successful round of the Uruguay round is a key for the United States. But those, there's also some enormous political changes out there. I would go back to the Middle East as having a reverberations for everybody. So it's a, but the point I'm trying to make here is, David, it's not a point for gloom and doom. It's a point to, for the United States to continue to lead. So it's an exciting time to be president in that regard. We get this domestic economy moving and it'll be great.
Mr. President, thank you very much indeed.